All right, can you all hear me okay?
Yep.
Great. So the first thing I usually start off with is asking for anybody who is on the other line's name, and just state that you give us permission to record the call. That way we can transcribe it later.
Totally fair. This is Evan Seltz. I am the drummer in Sleepy Kitties. And I give permission.
Thank you.
This is Paige Brubeck. I am the singer and guitar player in Sleepy Kitty, and I give permission to be recorded.
Thanks, guys. So I appreciate you getting on the line with me today. I'll try not to keep it too long, but I do want to touch upon a couple things about the new record and kind of your creative process in general, if that's cool. So the first place that I normally start is kind of getting a sense of where you two came together as a musical group. Evan, I know a little bit about your background, but if you can get us a sense of how Sleepy Kitty actually formed, that would be fantastic.
Well, so the briefest version of my background is I was in Harvey Danger in Seattle and then moved to Chicago and was in a band called Down Stems for my whole time there, and kind of Down Stems went kind of through a rising arc of experience and attention and such, and then kind of a falling arc at the end, because we I think people just kind of started shifting their priorities, but I was still really focused on making music, and Paige was undergoing kind of a similar arc with her band, which was called Stiletto Attack. So when we started dating, we found ourselves kind of talking about each other's bands a lot, and, you know, both the recording projects that we were in the midst of with our bands, and the process of writing songs and stuff, and eventually we found ourselves just blowing off steam together in Paige's practice space, and that turned out to be really fruitful and cathartic, even as our bands underwent their kind of final act.
Now, that was in Chicago, or was that in St. Louis?
That was in Chicago, and then as we, I think our very first project was. Bound Stems had been invited to contribute a cover of a Huey Lewis song to a Huey Lewis compilation that was coming together, and the rest of the band didn't really have any connection to Huey Lewis, but I had always, that was something that, you know, I loved when I was in grade school, and so Paige and I kind of took that over and worked out the version of Doing It All For My Baby.
Well, yeah, you offered, Bounce Stems didn't want to do it or couldn't do it, so you were like, well, Sleepy Kitty will do it, and that was kind of our first real song that we recorded, because we'd done kind of 17-minute avant-garde collage, sound collages together.
You couldn't get further away from Huey Lewis if you tried, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, so we had been doing this kind of like just experimental recordings, and, you know, really just for fun for us and for friends that would listen to them, and then when we had this opportunity to like record a song, we were like, okay, let's do it, and we tried to make it as interesting and as different from the original as we could.
It's pretty,
but still a sweetness.
It's pretty oddball, but if anything, sweeter than the original.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the first kind of recognizable song we recorded.
No.
And then before we knew it, we were kind of packing up for St. Louis together.
Now explain the move to me. Why Chicago to St. Louis? Was it for musical reasons or personal reasons?
I would say it was a little of everything. We were living in Wicker Park, and, you know, rent was just going up and up, and we were kind of like the neighborhood that we. The neighborhood that we had both moved to was kind of disappearing, where it was like the vintage stores and like the kind of the coffee shops were being kind of replaced by like the corporate versions of those things.
Yeah.
And actually now, like a few years later, some of those businesses have moved back in, they just kind of got shifted around and have moved back in that neighborhood. But basically, basically it was like our coffee shop closed, and we were like, that's the final straw. We got to get out of this neighborhood. And so we knew we were going to be moving anyways and looking for cheaper space. And we knew, as both of our bands were kind of fizzling out, we knew we needed practice space, living space, and we were increasingly doing more screen printing in our apartment, so we were like, probably going to need art studio space as well.
Yeah.
And especially because I was just graduating, so I wasn't going from art school, so I wasn't going to have access to the print lab anymore. But we kind of looked around and looked at, we were thinking about other neighborhoods, but there wasn't anywhere we were particularly excited to go within Chicago, and we'd both been there for a while, and we started looking around at other cities. And I grew up not far from St. Louis, so I was kind of aware that St. Louis was a cool city.
And we had good experiences every time we went down. Really good experiences every time we visited from Chicago.
Yeah, and so we just kind of randomly looked at, I just looked on Craigslist one day in St. Louis and found a huge former brewery, just a huge open live workspace that was a mess, and it looked like an underwater, it looked like a sunken building or something. But it was a really cool landlord who helped us make it habitable and usable, and we scraped a lot of paint off for 3 months.
Now, is this the quote-unquote art castle?
Yes,
this is the art castle. So, yeah, basically we found, we just found a whole floor of a warehouse-type building from the turn of the century that was the same amount of rent as our one bedroom in Chicago. So, and we were like, we can do anything we want here. We can play drums inside. We can have a screen printing, a high pressure washer for screen printing inside. And it was such a raw space, and working with the landlord who was trying to fill it with artists who could only improve the space, we were able to kind of set up a dream art studio.
Very cool.
And music space. So that's why we moved to St. Louis.
It's interesting that you bring that up. A couple issues back, we had a special section devoted to musicians who also make visual art. So I find it interesting that you guys, in addition to the music, have a lot of kind of multimedia and artistic projects going on. So I'll ask you the same question that I asked the people that we featured. Do you find that one fuels the other? In other words, does your art in any way impact your music, or does your music in any way impact your art, or do you find that they're kind of separate entities?
I feel like they proceed from the same exact urge. They're extensions of the same urge. I started at the college paper my sophomore year, I think, or maybe my junior year, which immediately derailed all of my schooling, but it's where I learned about writing and graphic design, and also where I met all the guys in Harvey Danger. And then my next job was working in a rock magazine, and I was making posters for the band, so, and writing about music, so all of those urges really proceed from the same exact starting point, which is just completely loving music and participating in it through as many different channels as possible. And then it's been that way for 15 years now for me.
Yeah,
and I would say the same. I think I've always kind of bounced between visual art and writing music and playing music. Like, I started writing songs when I was 13, and I've been painting and drawing my whole life, and I guess singing my whole life. And I feel like I've always just kind of, sometimes be on a streak of like, oh, I'm writing a bunch of songs, and then sometimes it's like, oh, I have so many ideas for a print or something, or I can't stop working on my sketchbook, and they kind of bounce back and forth. And sometimes that's great, because it's like, oh, now I know what I'm going to make this 7-inch look like,
yeah,
that we just recorded, and can use something from the sketchbook for that.
Cool.
Yeah.
So getting back to the music, I know that you've got Projection Room coming out, and that's your sophomore record. Maybe you can give us a little insight into your creative process as far as songwriting goes, and then maybe a little bit about how you guys actually record as a duo, and whether there's any kind of conscious thought to trying to make the record sound like it was created by more than just two people?
Sorry, we had a whole bunch of digital weirdness happen as you were asking the question.
Sorry about that. So I guess...
That's cool. It was happening from multiple...
Yeah, multiple phones started making sounds at once.
Do you want me to repeat it?
Yeah, please.
So, getting back to the new record, Projection Room, I was wondering if you could give us a little insight into both the songwriting creative process and a little bit about the recording process as a duo, and whether or not you make a conscious effort to try to make it sound like there's more than just two people creating the music.
I think live, we're always really interested in figuring out what we can do as a two-piece. But, I mean, this band started out of... Evan was coming out of a five-piece band, and I was in a seven-piece band briefly. So I feel like we're used to having a lot of ideas and a lot of different sounds going on when we write music. And for me, I feel like for every lead vocal line I write at least two harmony lines. And we never wanted to deny those urges of adding extra parts and overdubbing things. And I think we come in with the songs and we do a lot of demoing before we get into the studio. And so some of the time there'll be a part where, like, I'll be like, oh, and Evan, don't worry about that part because there's going to be this other thing going on. Or, like, the keys come in and he's like, what keys? Because, you know, I haven't been able to play it. And some of the ways that we work with loops, we can kind of do it live, but sometimes the way that the parts are, you can't really loop it. You have to do pre-recorded loops.
Which we don't do
on stage. And so I think that a lot of things Evan is finding out about some of the parts that I've written in the studio for the first time, or when we demo them for the first time, and I'm just kind of like trying to sing a guitar line while I'm doing this other guitar line, and trying to show him as much as I can before we get in the studio. But I think I don't necessarily think we're even trying to sound like more than two people, but we just write a lot of parts, I think, and I like to put all the parts down that I hear in my head, and whenever we're playing the songs as a two-piece, I'm hearing all these extra parts anyways. So the studio is just a place where we can actually share those sounds with everybody for the first time.
I think that a lot of bands have experienced the inherent tension between the studio reality and the live stage reality, kind of, no matter how many writing band members there are. And some people solve that by doing whatever they want in the studio and bringing as many musicians as it takes out on tour with them. Mm. Some people solve it by limiting, you know, by just playing the live band in the studio and doing that on stage and having those be as close as possible. And I think with Sleepy Kitty, we've decided to not limit ourselves, our ideas in the studio, but then
condense them all.
The live show becomes kind of a magic trick where you're trying to make more band members on stage than there are on stage, so that it's meant to be just kind of. It's meant to be kind of amazing. Like, if somebody knows the recordings, I remember when Delta Still started playing their first album and I was going to get my first chance to see them, I was so curious about how he was going to play these, like, seven guitar parts that all go on simultaneously in every song.
Yeah.
And then when I went and saw them, they were a three-piece, and he did, like, I really had no idea what he was going to do, and what he did came out, it was just amazing. It made perfect sense. It's kind of woven apart from all of these other guitars, and it didn't feel like anything was missing. In fact, it felt like there was, you know, there was more than enough stuff on stage. And I think Sleepy Kitty kind of is working from that idea of you know, the recorded version of a song is
Well,
it's almost like theater versus film in that way.
Yeah.
Where it's like you can't bring, you know, you see a lot of plays where people solve them. Sometimes you'll see a play with a huge cast and a ton of sets, and sometimes you'll see something that's in a, that's essentially a table and two chairs in a black box theater, and you still have to believe that they're on the set that they're on.
Now, presumably when you guys tour, it is just the two of you, right?
Yeah.
Is there ever the urge to bring an additional person or people on the road, or have guest musicians in different tour stops, or is that something that...
Like that.
That's definitely the urge, I will say. We kind of talk about that all the time. One thing that really drives me crazy is when I see a picture of a band and I hear they're written about as a two-piece, and there's two people in the band photo, and then you get to the show and there's five people on stage. And it's not just like they're doing extra, like, garnish parts. It's like they're doing crucial parts.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, hey, that's not a two-piece. But, I like right now really trying to do everything we can as a two-piece, and I don't know if we'll do that forever, but right now I really like kind of creating as much as we can, the two of us. Even though sometimes it drives me crazy because it's like, oh, if only there's just a guitar player on this besides me, or like, if only there was a bassist, or if only I could not have to be like doing this weird dance foot hopscotch routine to clear this loop and start that loop.
Yeah.
And turn down this volume with my toe.
I think one thing that we've done, it's not out of dislike of the instrument at all, but we have radically limited the amount of bass on our bass guitar on our albums. Not because we don't like it. In fact, Paige started on bass before she was on guitar, six-string guitar. But the thing about a bass guitar and drum setup is you really have that makes the song fundamentally a three-legged creature, and we are a two-legged creature. So so there's so many things that we can do in so many tracks. We have no problem filling up tracks in a recording session, but by taking away by not having a third voice that we can't account for on stage, you know, where it's just kind of fundamentally doing a different thing than the rest of us are, that allows us to kind of build a thing that that the two of us can do.
Very interesting.
I mean, you could imagine that the bassist is playing just kind of, you know, I kind of play the bass by doing it with my kick drum.
Yeah.
And Paige's amp fills in the bass zone. So it's not like, it's not lacking bassness. It just doesn't have this other phantom person.
Right.
Not playing, you know.
Did you have the foresight to think of that as you began recording as Sleeping Kitty, or is that something that just kind of evolved from, you know, the limitations of having two people?
I would say that kind of evolved. Like, it wasn't necessarily a conscious decision, but it was just kind of, you know, as you go on, every little decision you make kind of makes you more who you are.